have a seat. In my office, I had two chairs next to the side of my desk. One, at least to me, was designated as the new client chair. When a new client would walk in, I wanted them sitting in that chair, who was quite frankly closer to my desk, instead of the one a little farther away. They were identical chairs, but I directed them to the new client chair. There were two chairs, so if a husband and wife or a business partner would come in, they both could sit. If there were more than two, we'd move into a larger office. I would always have them sit there. That way, I could almost make knee-to-knee contact. I'm closer to them without infringing on their space, and that builds rapport. Remember we talked about looking at them, maintaining rapport by looking into their eyes when you're speaking? It's your office. You set the stage. Create rapport. Under no circumstances should you sit between two people when you're in a negotiation situation. If you're all sitting on the same side of the table and you've got one person on your right and one on your left, when you're looking at one of them, the other one could be flashing hand signals, yes, no, in, out, more or less, up, down, or anything else. If you're all on one side of the table, arrange it so you see them both. That being said, the most adversarial way to sit is on opposite sides of the table. That is so adversarial, you don't want a barrier between you and they. Now, if your desire is to set a polarity, this adversarial situation works. Just be clear of your intentions. And there are many situations where this is very appropriate. Unfortunately, too often in a divorce situation, you've got the attorney and one party or team on one side, and your attorney and your team on the other side. It's adversarial. There's no way around it. A great way for a peaceful negotiation is for you to sit at the end of the table so the other person or team can be on the same side, let's say the right side, and you can see them all, or obviously all on the left side, whatever works best for you. You are now sitting at a 90-degree angle to them. You can see them both, or all if there are more than one. You can show them papers if necessary without sliding across the table. There's no barrier between you. And by the way, a round table works best, as long as you remember not to sit between other parties. And this is why some very high power people have large desks, where you sit across from them. It creates the illusion of separation, power, and authority. There is an individual I knew, the president of a university, a very powerful man. His desk was probably 8 feet wide, at least it seemed like that, and probably 4 feet deep. I suspect his chair had a platform under it, elevating it. When you were sitting across from him, and behind him, by the way, was a huge picture window, you had no option but to be aware you were in the presence of authority and power. Your eyes could not accommodate to the light coming in the window, so he was always masked in an aura, the shadow. That's all you could see. When we would meet for business, he sat in this chair at the desk. When we would meet socially in his office, we sat in comfortable side chairs on equal footing with no light behind him. It was a fascinating experience. Remember that when you're meeting someone. If you are faced with that situation, the high back chair, the huge desk outlined by a huge window, I encourage you to see if you can rearrange your seat off to the side so you can at least see the person's face. If not, take a good deep breath and recognize the implication of power for what it is. I also encourage you not to set up your meeting like this. It's a highly adversarial and very disconcerting situation, unless, of course, that's your desire, that's your intention. And where do you see this? Any courtroom. The judge's desk is huge and significantly elevated. The unstated declaration is one of power and authority. Of course, the black robes help amplify that statement. So just remember, have a seat. In the next segment, I'll discuss the power of withdrawing the offer. Withdrawing the offer. Withdrawing the offer sets up a polarity. It sets up a thirst, an increased desire, in most cases. Remember, none of these rules are hard and fast. They're guidelines, the basis. It's a template for you to build upon. And like anything else, as you go through your own education, your own learning curve, you will bend what you learn here, mold it so that what you learn here becomes you. What you are learning here is just the foundation, the skill sets. I invite you to practice, practice, practice. Okay, how many times or how often has it happened to you? You wanted to buy something and the seller said, you know, I've only got one of these left, and if you don't get it now, someone else is going to come along and get it. Now, if you're in that gray area, this comment may be the tipping point. It may be incentive enough for you to make that buying decision now. Now, if you're selling, it's very powerful. Many years ago, I was selling one of our cars, a Lincoln. A young man called from the ad, and he made the mistake of saying, "I collect Lincolns." It was obvious he was not a student of mine. This is not a strong opening for a negotiation with someone who was selling a Lincoln. He lost all his leverage. I then knew the young man was motivated to buy the car. After we discussed the model, condition, mileage, engine, and a lot of other aspects of the car, he asked me the price. We went back and forth a little bit. He was offering a lot less than I was willing to accept, and I finally said to him, "I've already got a full dollar offer on the car. I'm not open to negotiation, and here's what's so. The first person who shows up with cash or certified funds is going to take the car away. If you want it, you've got to come and get it. I also know the other guy is interested, but I need to move the car fast. You may not get it if you wait." He said, "I'll be there in an hour," and he was. He told me he went right to the bank to get cash and came over. I signed over the title, and he added one more Lincoln Continental to his collection. I mean, he blew it when he started. Good for him, but he had no leverage because he declared up front, "I'm a collector." I was willing to withdraw the offer. I really did have another offer on the car. That guy, by the way, was not going to come over until the following day. I called him and let him know the car had already been sold. By withdrawing the offer, the buyer was fearful of losing what he wanted, and the pain of the potential loss was sufficient motivation to trigger him into an immediate buying decision. Pain, real or perceived, is a very powerful motivator. And I suspect you've been in a similar situation, and you made decisions based upon availability or potential loss of the item you desired. Regardless of buying or selling, the ability to withdraw the offer is enormous motivation. And this also shows up in relationships. I was speaking with a friend of mine about her relationship. We were talking about what was working and what wasn't working. One of the things she said that wasn't working was the feeling the guy was not really committed to her. I suggested she tell him what she felt, and she was no longer interested in pursuing this relationship. As in any negotiation, and there's just as much negotiation in a relationship as there is in business, actually, there's a lot more, because it's constant. So, as in any negotiation, I suggested she must be ready to deal with the consequences of withdrawing the offer, and that the deal, or in this situation, the relationship, might come to an end. Her comment was interesting. She said, "Oh no, if I tell him I'm not interested in pursuing a relationship, he'll pursue me even more." And indeed, he did. Now, she ultimately ended that relationship for other reasons, codependency only being part of it. Another scenario for withdrawing the offer is to actually get someone to pay the original price you offered. Let's say you're selling components for some larger production system. You verbally offer a price that you know is fair and reasonable. Actually, you can even put the offer in writing. The buyer counters asking for a lower price. You agree with the buyer and tell him or her that you'll see what you can do. You have to check with the manager. Does deferring to higher authority sound familiar? When you get back to the buyer, you tell them you're afraid you made a mistake. The manager is actually insisting on a much higher price per unit than you originally offered. Immediately, the low price offered by the buyer evaporates, and the buyer is now negotiating with you for the original fair price you offered in the first place. You become the hero. You tell the buyer. You go to bat for them. You'll tell the manager you screwed up. You're going to lock in the original price, and you tell the buyer, "I'll take care of it." So withdrawing the offer becomes very powerful in sustaining your original price. One of the companies I work with was using technology we learned was covered by an overseas patent. When the CEO of our company approached the patent holder to work out a deal, he was offered an absurd proposition. The patent holder wanted 10% of all gross sales. What to do? I suggested we simply refuse the offer, withdraw the offer. At the time, we weren't even certain the patent was valid. However, we were willing to honor it. Turns out, the patent was indeed valid, and we also discovered the patent was being violated by several other companies in this country. Well, here's what happened. The owner of the patent eventually approached us and ultimately offered a very reasonable licensing fee. Not only that, since he was not protecting his patent, he offered us the right to defend it and participate in revenues which we never would have been party to. By withdrawing the offer, we were ready to walk away. The other party came back, was drawn back into the negotiation, and a very reasonable deal was able to be achieved. It was a huge win for both of us. All the skills and information you're learning through this program, they intertwine and they interplay, and you may be able to use some as standalone, and you can use many of the strategies in the same negotiation. While you can use anything you learn here by itself, picture everything you learn here as a necklace, all connected. You apply the most appropriate, what is appropriate, in that moment. It is important to know that withdrawing the offer may backfire. That is, if you withdraw the offer, the other person or team may simply say, okay, the deal is off. So in all situations, if you're playing this strategy, you must be ready for the consequence you may not enjoy. So remember, withdrawing the offer. In our next segment, I'll talk about the importance of body language. Body language. People believe more what they see than what they hear. You may have heard body language is important, and it is. However, it is the change in body language that is so much more important than the actual posture of the body itself. For example, if someone is standing with her arms crossed, it doesn't necessarily mean she's turned off and not listening. She may be cold, her hands may be tucked under her arms just to keep them warm. It may be a position in which she feels at ease, at peace. Perhaps this position reduces the tension in her muscular system just enough so she feels more relaxed. Now, if you're in the middle of a conversation with someone, whether they're standing or sitting, and they lean back and cross their arms across their chest and kind of tuck their chin into their chest, that's a pretty clear indication you've just turned them off, as distinct from just standing around because they're cold and have one arm tucked under the other just to keep warm. Now, if you're in the middle of a conversation with someone, whether they're standing or sitting, and they lean back and cross their arms across their chest and kind of tuck their chin into their chest, that's a pretty clear indication they have just turned you off, as a distinction from just standing around because they're cold and have one arm tucked under the other just to keep warm. Just be aware of the changes in body language. You need to establish a baseline to know from where the deviation occurs. Now, rapid eye blinking generally suggests someone may not be telling the truth. They may also have an eyelash under their contact lens. Be aware of the context in which these changes in body language occur. If you're sitting at a table and you're speaking with someone and they take their glasses off, put them on the table, and start rubbing the bridge of their nose, you may as well stop talking. They've just stopped listening. They've gone inside, and to all intents and purposes, you're no longer there. They may be sick and tired of what they're hearing. They're just no longer listening. Think of the times when you've done this. Whether or not you have glasses, that is, you gently shake your head back and forth, left and right, and gently massage the bridge of your nose. It's like, why am I listening to this? Whether it's family, a child, business, a friend, anyone and anywhere, be aware of the body language. Again, it's the change in body language, the shift. If someone starts rubbing their hand across their forehead, while it may mean they have a headache, it more likely means something like, why am I putting up with this? Classically, if someone is rubbing or scratching the side of their nose, this suggests they're about to tell or are in the middle of telling a lie. In the real world, of course, it can also mean they've got an itch on their nose. Steepling of fingers, you know, when your fingertips are together and your thumb comes together and your chin rests on them, that usually suggests an arrogance or a superior sense of being. And again, I'm emphasizing generally or usually because there are certainly no hard and fast rules with this. But again, think back to the last time you did such a thing. Where were you? Where was your consciousness? Where was your mindset? What were you thinking? If someone kind of cups their chin in their hand, that usually suggests a thoughtful or pensive moment. They're pondering what you said. If they start nodding their head up and down to go with it, that means they're agreeing with you. If someone is rubbing the back of their neck, if you're in conversation with someone and they start rubbing the back of the neck, it might mean, actually it usually means that they're annoyed. However, it could also mean they have a lot of tension in their nervous system, in the muscular system. And as soon as this meeting's over, they're on the way to the chiropractor to get some assistance in getting it resolved. Now, if something like that happens immediately following something that you said, you may not even be sure of what you said. There's a high probability the tension came from what it is you said, and they just got annoyed. If while you're speaking, someone leans in, there's a high probability they're really paying attention, and now they're intent on hearing everything you say. If you said something inflammatory, intentionally or not, and the person is sitting and they quickly get up out of their seat, you know you may have just crossed a threshold, and they're not angry or really upset. And also, this could be a very clever negotiation strategy, feigning the annoyance to get you to shift your position. Just be aware of the change in the tension. And your response? Don't play. If you react in kind and get angry, you raise the bar in the tension level in the conversation or the negotiation. It takes you further away from resolution. You might just flinch and say something like, "Well, it's evident you really got upset about something. Would you like to talk about what it was?" Depending on the nature of the conversation or negotiation, they may scream and yell, and my invitation again is don't play. Stay away from matching their energy on this one. Take a good deep breath. Get a drink of water. Anything to give you a few moments to settle in. Take a breath. It's always good. Breathe in your nose. Breathe out your mouth. And remember, earlier on I talked about one of the strategies of agreeing. Rather than go through that strategy again here, just remember it is a strategy you can call upon to diffuse the situation, diffuse the tension. Agree with them. "Wow, I can see you got angry about that. Let me know what's going on. Let's talk about it." And if this is a negotiation with more than one person, this may be a real practical demonstration of good guy, bad guy. I'll talk about that in detail later on. For the moment, know that this is when one of the members of the team has to throw a pen or paper down at the table and go storming out of the room. You can laugh and say something like, "Well, that's interesting. This looks like good guy, bad guy." Your response to that kind of exercise, "You're not going to play that game with me, are you?" But this segment is about body language, not good guy, bad guy. Again, we'll go over that later. However, the example here is so you can see once again how all the elements in this program intertwine. So be aware of the content of what you just said and the context in which the other person changes their body language. Remember, body language. In the next segment, I'll discuss how close do you want to get. Proximity. How close do you get to somebody? In the United States, people respect distance. Actually, they demand it. If you crowd somebody, if you come in too close, they're going to back off. They're going to be very uncomfortable. Now, if that's your intention, well, that may be something you want to do. But if you want to have a conversation or negotiation with someone, it's not a wise thing to do. And we're not talking about an intimate moment here. As an example, if you watch football or basketball, and this is classically where you'll see this, you'll occasionally see a coach tearing into somebody, or two players of the opposite teams going at it, and they are nose to nose with each other. It's highly confrontational. Anytime you've been that close to somebody, the odds are, whether they're coming in or you're coming in, it's so confrontational. Now, this is an extreme example, of course, but well, you get the idea. Back off. Give the other person room. Give them physical space. In many countries, in Asian countries, for example, it is very common to be nose to nose. Well, almost nose to nose. These cultures have a high population density, so closer proximity is just more common than in the U.S. You may remember the television series created by and starring Alan Funt called Candid Camera. That show actually premiered in 1948. They would set up interesting situations and set up cameras to film people's reactions to various events and circumstances. We'll talk more about some candid camera routines later on, but for this segment, I'm going to talk about the one where they had two people sitting at a diner. If you don't recall what a diner was, there was a service counter and you sat and ate at the service counter. In one particular episode, an actor would pick up the ketchup, and when she put it down, she put it just a little too far to her left, just mildly infringing in the personal space of the person seated to her left. That person looked like a large, burly truck driver. Then she picked up the salt and put that down just a little bit too far to her left. While she appeared to be oblivious to the placement of the condiments, the guy sitting to her left started giving her nasty looks. She played the part of the dumb blonde and was equally oblivious to his staring at her. She picked up another condiment and put it further to the left. Now, the camera is on the other side of the counter in the kitchen, and you're actually watching this burly guy sitting there fuming after the second or third item, looking belligerently at her. She's just minding her own business, not even looking up. You are sitting giggling, watching him get so frustrated. After a while, maybe after the fourth or fifth apparent transgression, he takes his arm and sweeps everything back to her side. He doesn't say anything. He just pushed everything back. Why? She invaded his personal space. Give people space. Don't crowd them. Give them breathing room to feel safe. How do you feel when someone comes into your personal space? If it's ever happened to you, you know it can be very uncomfortable, even intimidating. And as with some other strategies here, if your intention is to intimidate somebody, well, just be prepared for the consequences. And as with some other strategies here, if your intention is to intimidate somebody, well, just be prepared for the consequences. It may be more than just an arm pushing stuff back to your side. In most conversations and most negotiations, however, you're better off giving people space. Just remember, proximity. In the next segment, which is on the next CD, I'll discuss the all-powerful nibble.